Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Tea and Murder, an Agatha Christie podcast, part interview show, part book club, all Agatha Christie. I'm your host, Rebecca Tundy Norman, and I am thrilled to have with me today Levi Higgs. Levi is a jewelry and decorative arts historian based in New York City. Levi is also head of archive and brand heritage at David Webb Jewels. You can follow his glittering day-to-day on Instagram at Levi_Higgs. It's H-I-G-G-S. And if you are not following Levi and you are interested in jewelry, it is a must do because he just showcases the absolute most beautiful pieces you could imagine. Welcome, Levi.
Wow. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. So I'm going to start with my classic first question, which is, how did you come to Agatha Christie? Are you an Agatha Christie fan? And if so, what have you read of her work?
I am an Agatha Christie fan in principle.
Okay.
I have not read
You're conceptually an Agatha Christie
yes,
fan.
Yes, yeah. It's very like on my mood board.
Okay. That's such a great answer.
Of twee things that I love. I love murder mysteries. I love all things British. I mean...
You're an Anglophile.
Yes.
Okay.
She's wonderful.
Yeah.
But have I read the dearth of books she's written? Absolutely not.
Who has the time other than me, for example?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's why we're here. I've definitely read Murder on the Orient Express, which
Fantastic.
We'll sort of get to. But this was the second one I think I've sat through the full book.
Yeah.
So it was...
Sat through the full book? You make it sound
wow.
wonderful.
I need to tone it down a little bit.
Reel it on it. Oh, my gosh. So, okay. So you've read a couple of her books.
Yes. But... I've seen movies.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I've seen anything Miss Marple. I've definitely seen, you know, the new Kenneth Branagh
you
films.
Have. Okay.
Ready for the next one, The Haunting in Venice.
Right. We're all waiting on tenterhooks for that one.
Just sort of a casual consumer of,
okay.
I would say. Yeah.
But you are, in general, a huge reader and a mystery fan.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what is it that you look for in mysteries in general?
Whenever I'm choosing a book and I try to like let the spirit speak to me of like what I'm gonna choose from my to be read pile,
yeah.
I'll like temper a serious book that I just finished with like a fast-paced mystery, so
okay.
I'm always sort of like doling one in the cadence of what I'm reading. And so to that end, I want something that's just making me keep reading and turning the page and finishing
mm-hmm.
what's going on.
Okay.
Yeah, I love like staying up late to like pound a book at the end.
Isn't that the best feeling when you're
yes.
like, I gotta get to the end of this?
Totally.
Yeah. What recently has kept you awake?
I think the most recent mystery I read was, The Only One Left by
okay.
Riley Sager.
Oh, I've heard that's
yeah,
very good.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. You liked it? I love
yeah.
the cover. The cover is like classic style.
Right.
Yeah.
It's coastal Maine. I think it's set in the 80s. There's a woman who's... like paralyzed and can't speak, and there's
okay.
a mystery around her backstory. It's very good.
It sounds like a John Carpenter film, but a book of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love that. Mm-hmm. So that's what you look for in a mystery. And like other types of book, you're reading a lot of nonfiction. What else are you reading?
I'm reading The Idiot right now, which I'm sort
I've
of...
heard that's great. I haven't read it.
Yeah. It's sort of trance-inducing. It's just kind of
okay.
like stream of consciousness in a way,
yeah.
and it's... good,
yeah.
but it's making me like work for it a little
more so than a mystery would.
Yeah,
I understand. And you just read The Guest by Emma Klein.
I did just read The Guest. That was super summary.
Yeah, you were into that.
Okay. I had to. It felt very zeitgeist.
Yeah.
I try to read some nonfiction. I like New York history. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of like untold stories of 19th century, early 20th century people that I'm interested in. So I try to read a bit of everything.
Okay. Yeah. Fantastic. And so you're the head of archive and brand heritage at the renowned David Webb Jules. What was your journey to that world, that position?
Yeah. So I guess I've always been interested in jewelry since childhood, in the way that children are interested in like tiny, beautiful things and collecting things and having a treasure box and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I studied art history at school at the University of Washington in Seattle. I didn't want to go straight into an art history master's program, and I threw work that I did at UW, I was interested in like Victorian genre scenes, and I was looking at objects in rooms, painted in these rooms, and you know, everything in a Victorian painting is like symbolic.
Right.
So like the dropped glove and the music on the piano and the
globe and
exactly, yeah. Like everything meant something. So I loved sort of looking at decorative arts that way, and I was like, okay, let's explore this a little bit. Decorative arts master's programs are few and far between. There were a few good ones in New York. The one I chose ultimately was at Parsons through the Cooper Hewitt, which is the Smithsonian's Design Museum in the Upper East Side. And through that program, I got to focus a lot on jewelry specifically. So I'm a true decorative arts design jewelry historian. And I pretty much went, I had connections to people at David Webb through the master's program and through some other, a first job that I had in New York. And I basically went straight into David Webb after graduating with my master's degree. And I've been there a decade plus.
Wow.
That's quite a long time. But it's an amazing brand. It's a great American brand. And I sort of the keeper of all the archives and drawings and renderings. And
yeah. What a rich history. Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of, in terms of the archive pieces that were never made?
Tons.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands. Absolutely. I mean, he was very prolific. And we constantly sort of mine what we have to be able to, yes, create new jewelry, but also keep true to like the brand DNA and things that he was thinking of himself when he was alive. He died in 1875, so we have a lot to draw from.
It's incredible. Mm-hmm. So you deal with a lot of very storied jewelry. What makes a piece of jewelry like historically important or interesting?
Great question.
Thank you so much.
You did your homework.
I did.
So jewelry is so useless in a sense. It does nothing.
How dare you? But go on.
It does nothing functional. It's a capsule of beauty, really. And in the way that other decorative arts are functional, like here we are on chairs, here we are walking on a rug, you know, it does something in a room. Mm. But jewelry it functions at the highest echelons of society. It trickles down to everyone has a wedding ring or what. Like there's jewelry in everyone's life in some sense. And I find that they are kind of the perfect capsules for storytelling, for design storytelling, design history. You think about the tropes of Art Deco design, it is perfectly embodied in jewelry from that period or any period. Pick a period and the jewelry is like very like to a T what that design period is about.
Yeah.
So I love that the provenance can be really important and interesting, or the design can tell a rich story, or the materials themselves are very unique and rare and valuable. Like there's just so much that kind of swirls around this very like mysterious decorative art, and it's very appealing. I don't know. It's seductive. What can I say?
It is seductive. So why do you think then that jewelry is often used as a plot device in mysteries? Is it about like, what is about a jewel theft or a heist that kind of captures our imagination?
I mean, I think it lends a certain glamour to a murder mystery or a heist or something like that. It's not something that everyone at its highest level is brushing up against, like the, you know, these important rubies in the story.
Yeah.
Everyone knows about them, but
yeah, we'll talk about that.
Right. But they're kind of these like legendary stones, right? So for them to be kind of snatched away is really disturbing and kind of drives the plot of like, we have to get them back. They've been taken. They're so valuable. Like there's a lot of things at stake with high jewelry like that.
And what would be, what do you think makes it more interesting than, for example, like a mystery that's about financial gain in other ways? Mm-hmm. Like, what is it about jewelry? Is it like the personal element of jewelry that makes it a little bit more like close to home?
I mean, if it's worn on the body, it's very personal, right. And it's also very tangible. It can be, it's not just a bag of cash. It's not just like, oh, the accounts are going to transfer into my name. It's not a will in that kind of paperwork legality sense of, you know, financial gain. This is like, oh, snatch the box and run. And it can be dramatic. It can be, I don't know, sort of thrusting forward the plot in like a very visceral way.
Yeah. And I think what you were saying before about kind of jewelry being non-functional is interesting in that sense, because there are obviously jewelry heists where it's about getting the jewelry and then selling it. But there are also jewelry heists where it's about just getting the jewels and having them. And that's such a fascinating thing to me, the idea that people would commit that kind of crime just to have something beautiful.
Right. I mean, think about the theft of like Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. Like, those paintings can't be sold. They're so well known. You know, maybe they can move around in like a black market sense, but whoever has them wants them.
Yeah.
Right. So
I would like them if you would like to send them to me.
So there was just a big jewelry heist in Germany, I think, with like pieces that are still missing from this museum. They got a lot back, but like the Dresden green diamond was going to be there, but it was actually at the Met at the time.
Okay.
So it you know, escaped the heist. But sadly, a lot of things do get broken up and recut and moved around that way. But, you know, it's kind of, once again, seductive to think about like some villain in a lair who's rubbing his hands together trying to get this like certain diamond or something. I don't know. Like, you never know.
And is there also, as I'm saying it, like an element of like, we can never know in terms of jewelry and big stones, what's ill-gotten and what isn't?
Well, at a certain point, an antique diamond or any stone could be recut and not identifiable from its original form. You know, you look at like the Hope Diamond, and there's documented faceting and different forms that it had over the centuries.
Okay.
And you know, if someone, God forbid, were to snatch the Hope Diamond and take it to, you know, a cutting facility and break it up into five different stones, like, that could happen.
Yeah.
And no one would necessarily know which chunks were which and where they came
from.
Right,
it's not like when you look through a microscope, it's like, Hope Diamond,
right.
TM. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, things can definitely disappear forever, which is a little frightening.
Frightening and also fascinating in terms of, like, something like a diamond, which is meant to be literally a diamond is forever, that it can kind of take on different shapes.
Sure.
So I'm going to give a little historical note about the book we're talking about, which is The Mystery of the Blue Train. Thank you for reading it.
My pleasure.
The Mystery of the Blue Train is a Poirot mystery published in the US and UK in 1928. It revolves around a jewelry theft on a train headed for the French Riviera, so lots of glamorous things happening at once. Although the jewel theft may be a classic mystery plot device, it actually does not appear that frequently in Christie books. Although, I mean, she wrote so many, it's like, can anything really appear that frequently? Typically, her murders have to do more with like straightforward financial gain. The only other book I can recall having a jewelry heist as part of the plot is A Cat Among the Pigeons, and I'm sure my listeners will tell me if I'm wrong. And there are a handful of other short stories in which there are jewelry thefts, including Plymouth Express, Double Clue, and the jewelry robbery at the Grand Metropolitan. There are also jewel thefts in After the Funeral and Hickory Dickory Dock, but those are used as red herrings and rather than the reason for the crime. Critical reception for the book was overall fairly good, although Christie herself actually called this her least favorite book. That may be because she was writing it and struggling quite hard with it, both before and after her infamous disappearance in 1926. Which you can find out more about the specifics of in our episode with Kelsey McKinney called The Four Suspects. So this would also have been around the time that she divorced Archie Christie, and also the death of her mother, who she loved very much. So there was a lot going on in her life at this time. So while I don't think this is her worst book by like a lot, I can understand why she wouldn't want to revisit it. The most notable adaptation of this book is the ITV Poirot episode with David Suchet. There are quite a lot of changes to that plot in the adaptation, including putting pretty much everyone on the train at once, and also switching things around a little bit, like Mirelle becomes Rufus's mistress rather than Derek's, for example.
In that version, Elliot Gould plays Rufus Van Alden, which is so fantastic because, as mystery lovers will know, Gould also plays Philip Marlowe, who I consider kind of the American counterpart in many ways to Poirot. And in 1973's The Long Goodbye, directed by Robert Altman. And not to get off track, but if you have not seen The Long Goodbye, please watch it. It is so great. It is so stylish. And 1970s Elliot Gould is, like, very much my type. So, Levi, can you please give us a one-minute or so synopsis of The Mystery of the Blue Train?
Sure. There are so many people with the name Kay that I, even as I was reading it over the course of it, I was like,
yes.
Hold on.
Yes.
Basically, there is a woman who goes on a train, mm-hmm. and she is given these very important rubies. Her father's sort of watching over her. There's some, like, mystery things happening off stage previous to the train trip.
Mm-hmm.
She gets strangled. Before she gets strangled, she meets another woman on the train who is sort of a pointless character. We'll talk about that.
Yep.
And lo and behold, Poirot is on the train as well to solve
what
the
luck.
Mystery. To me, it felt a little bit like Murder on the Orient Express light.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they're investigating who, you know, the different stops along the course of the train, mm-hmm. and who could have been seen going in and out. And it took a long time also for the mystery to be solved. It was like weeks since it happened.
Yeah.
And then I'm doing a terrible job of summing it up.
So I really am enjoying this.
Please save me. But so there's a lot of people with named K's. There's a dropped cigarette case, I think, that had a K on it. That was sort of an important clue.
Yes.
There's a maid who also ends up disguised as a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Poirot solves it and fingers the jewel thief who, yeah.
Yes. Perfect summary, no notes.
Very embarrassed for a book that I just read a week ago. But
but I think what you've kind of cornered about this book is there are so many elements that it's very hard to do a summary of this book. I'm sorry that you had to summarize this one because it isn't like Murder on the Orient Express where everything happens on the train
and
journey.
Yeah,
it's so tight. This is a very diffuse book in a lot of ways. And as you said, Catherine Gray, who is in many ways a lovely character, I find her completely superfluous to this book, and unfortunately, and she appears in it constantly.
Yeah, it just seemed like she was in existence for someone for Poirot to talk to,
exactly.
like to pontificate to about his thoughts, and
yeah.
I don't know.
Exactly, and he could have just done that with Rufus Van Alden.
Right.
So I think it was unnecessary, but I also just, sorry, not really necessary to the trope or to the plot, but the idea that men keep being obsessed with her eyes
yes.
was like, in what world are men constantly talking about a woman's eyes?
Mm-hmm.
And gray eyes at that, which I've never seen a person with gray eyes. There are so many Agatha Christie books in which she talks about someone with gray eyes.
Wow, maybe it's like cigarettes or something, like too many drugs that, I don't know, just drain people of color. Who knows?
Yeah, or maybe it was like at the, you know, maybe
cocaine toothpaste.
Yeah, exactly.
Something.
Cocaine and the Coca-Cola. It was like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, so that's that. But so this book has a famous ruby, the Heart of Fire,
yes.
that seemingly everybody who talks about it just knows about,
mm-hmm.
right? And so much so that someone could make a convincing replica of this stone and the whole necklace without having seen it because
right.
it's in her care, right? It's in Ruth Kettering, the victim's care. In your experience, how historically accurate is it that that stones would be this famous and that so many people would know about them?
I mean, honestly, I think yes. I think,
oh, really? Okay.
I mean, think about the Hope Diamond. Think about Evelyn Walsh McLean
mm-hmm.
and like her sort of, I don't know, outlandish Washington, D.C. society headlines that she had splashed about
uh-huh.
like wearing the Hope Diamond and nothing else and appearing at the top of a staircase like scandalously for one moment before all of her party guests and
uh-huh.
all the terrible things that happened to her family because of that curse and the financial ruin. So like there's definitely tabloid stories
okay.
of, you know, known diamonds and stones. And I think, you know, there's a lot of like, what's the phrase I'm looking for? Like collective consciousness around famous diamonds and gemstones like that. Like everyone thinks that opals are cursed to this day because of a book called Anne of Geierstein, that came out in the 19th century. And, uh-huh. and, you know, opals are famously temperamental stones because they're water-based, so they can, like, crack and break. And okay. thus people think, oh, if my opal is ruined, it's because of the bad luck that's in my life or something. So there's a lot of, like, okay. legends and lore that can kind of seep into public perception of mm-hmm. a gemstone or what it's used for, or why you have it as an engagement ring mm-hmm. or whatever, like all these kind of societal norms.
Yeah. But like to the degree that if someone saw, like for me, there are, I guess, a handful of maybe necklaces or pieces of jewelry that I would recognize, right?
Sure.
And I really like jewelry, so I would maybe go out of my way to learn about those things. But, like, to the person on the street, would they be like, it's the Heart of Fire? Like,
okay, well, maybe, maybe not. But, like, there could be newspaper articles
okay,
about it. There
all right.
could, there
yeah,
could
like
be
in the society pages
press
and stuff. Okay.
About it.
All right.
Yeah, is someone on the street necessarily going to point at it and be like, there she blows? No. But in this small world that she's created on the train, like...
Yeah, I suppose...
People the... in the know.
Yeah, I suppose yeah. it is a lot of people in the know. Like, Catherine Gray doesn't seem to necessarily know about these stones, whereas, right. like, the Comte de la Roche and Mirel and people who would, like, be overly interested right. in money, like, gaining financially through a stone. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I take it.
It was a little confusing to me about whether they were set or not. Like, they seemed to be loose
yes.
at some point, but then Mirel had one on a necklace or something.
Yeah.
So it kept sort of changing forms. And I was like, hold on. What's the reality here? But
I found that hard to gauge as well. From what I gathered, the stones are bought at first loose. Mm-hmm. And then they're set into a necklace.
Mm-hmm.
And then that necklace is what goes to Ruth Kettering.
Yes.
When Ruth Kettering loses it and the stones are then sold to Monsieur Papopoulos.
Yes. Loved him.
Yeah, so, and then he takes the stones apart, and then the necklace with just the large Heart of Fire ruby
yes.
is then given to Mirel.
Yes, yes.
Is
yes.
my understanding. Okay, so this book has a paste imitation of jewels,
mm-hmm.
which many heist books and films seem to have. Like, there's a replica, and that's kind of part of the plot of, like, knowing how it disappeared. The Ocean's 8 would be a great example of
yep.
having recently done this.
Yep, yep.
What is paste jewelry? Is it literal paste? I need to understand. I've never understood what paste jewelry is. And is it really that difficult to tell from the real thing?
I would not say someone would look at a real ruby and a paste ruby and uh-huh. not be able to tell the difference.
Okay.
A paste stone is, it's not a geologically mineralogical stone.
Yeah.
It's like costume jewelry, but it's made in a certain way
okay.
that... You know, Georgian jewelry from, like, the 1830s, 1820s mm-hmm. is often paste jewelry. Like,
okay.
Bridgerton is all about paste jewelry just
okay.
because that was the style. That was the sort of fashionable way to have all these multicolored foil-backed rhinestones, essentially. Like,
okay.
they're often crystals, and they have, like, a metallic foil behind them to
reflect.
To give it color
yeah.
and reflect, yes, yeah, so that it can't be... wet or else the foil will rust and ruin the stone.
Okay.
Sometimes if you're of a certain status of person and you have real jewelry that are diamonds or rubies or whatever, you'll have your paste jewelry that could
yes.
be like travel jewelry
right.
or your like, you know, non-committal jewelry. But there definitely is paste jewelry that's like very high quality in
okay.
craftsmanship and very collectible today.
Okay.
I know quite a few dealers who deal in paste jewelry that's very desirable and very historical and cool.
Okay. But so, I mean, in this story, mm-hmm. Ruth Kettering's Heart of Fire rubies are taken and replaced with paste.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like it would be very hard, especially with something like a ruby, to not see the difference.
It would have to be... pre-planned, and rubies
yeah.
have what the trade calls silk in it.
Okay.
There's so many different qualities of ruby, but
yeah.
a ruby always has this sort of like sheen, this interior sort of velvetiness to
mm.
it because of like the crystal structure. I'm not
okay.
a gemologist, so please don't ask further questions.
Okay.
But it's,
I will not.
It's something like that. It has this like inner luster
yeah.
that would be hard to mimic with a clear rhinestone and foil backing. Like, that's
okay.
just going to give you a clear red stone that doesn't have that same sort of inner velvetiness.
Yeah. And it sounds like it also has to be set in order for
yep. Yeah, it does.
To even
it does.
Red.
A paste stone, you could have, you could have a glass.
A piece of glass,
a piece of glass.
Yeah.
But I don't think paste could not have a backing with foil, at least in my sort of experience of paste jewelry. But
okay. Yeah. And so is it called paste jewelry because it's pasted to the foil? Is that...
That is a really good question, and I don't know why it's
called...
Because
it's not made of paste.
I don't think it's made of paste.
Yeah.
I think it's a crystal.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to text someone immediately after this and ask why it's called paste. No, it's not like glue. It's not paste in that way,
okay.
or you know, some sort of mixture that hardens. I think it's like a cut stone.
Yeah.
Like
or
crystal.
Glass. Yeah.
Or glass.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's right. So interesting, because so much of the jewelry heist books of like this era
mm-hmm.
rely on kind of the understanding of what paste jewelry mm-hmm. is. And I've never really found that good of an explanation.
Yeah.
So thank you for
that. The call out I will make, mm-hmm. Simon Teakle in Greenwich, Connecticut is
yep.
an amazing dealer of paste jewelry.
Okay.
And their Instagram will have a lot of information about it.
Amazing. We'll put that in the episode notes.
And Larkspur and Hawk is a contemporary jeweler who makes paste jewelry in homage to Georgian jewelry from like the early 1800s.
Okay.
And they loaned to Bridgerton recently, so they're like a very like up on it paste
yeah.
jeweler. The founder of that company did the same master's program as I did, so she's very like in the decorative arts, in the know, loves
okay.
that period of history.
Fantastic.
So, yeah.
Okay. So in this book, the relationship between Rufus Van Alden and his daughter, Ruth Kettering, is for me kind of the saving grace of this book. I think that Van Alden's grief when his daughter dies is very moving. And I think that could potentially be related to the fact that that Agatha Christie lost her mother around the time that she was writing this book. So
right.
I think that that grief probably found its way into her writing. And Rufus is the one who gives his daughter the Heart of Fire, which is the reason she's ultimately killed. And there's kind of this idea that the stone is cursed. Everyone who's worn it has met bad luck. Tell me a little bit more about your interpretation of like the doomed jewelry or doomed stone literary device.
Absolutely. I mean, I sort of mentioned the Hope Diamond and
yeah.
Evelyn Walsh McLean. Like that was very much a thing that was out there that people were aware of and
yeah.
all the misfortunes that befell her family. And I'm going to mention opals again. There's
yeah.
even the opals even trickle into like Harry Potter. Like think of the sixth book when someone touches an opal necklace and is cursed and Snape has to like deal with it and not touch it. Like it, that's a sort of contemporary use of cursed opals.
Okay.
The book The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins
mm-hmm.
is less about a cursed stone, but very much about like the misfortune around a stone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, so George F. Kunz is one of my favorite sort of figures from jewelry history. He was Tiffany's chief gemologist in the 19th century, and he was responsible for writing all these books that sort of informed public perception about what gemstones were used for, what they could be used for.
Mm-hmm.
There's a book called... George F. Kunz wrote this book called The Curious Lore of Precious Stones,
mm-hmm.
and it was really about detailing, you know, why you should wear amethyst to prevent drunkenness and why opals were said to be cursed when they're really not.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that that's always kind of been like the old wives' tales that surround and swirl around jewelry.
Mm.
I think moonstone was supposed to be a stone that you should wear as an engagement ring because it was supposed to like foretell in the sort of mystical depths of the stone itself. It was supposed to foretell what the relationship would be like, and only diamonds only became engagement rings due to like commercialism and
right.
you know, advertising and that
De Beers.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's just kind of a deep-seated public perception of why certain stones are cursed or bad luck or good luck
or
whatever.
That's so interesting. I personally also think there's an element, because often the stones that are the ones that are cursed are kind of so outrageously expensive.
Mm.
There's an element of like getting more than you bargained for,
mm.
or like to want something so beautiful and to have it, to capture it
yeah.
is kind of a sin.
There's always
you know?
A price to pay.
Yes, yeah. exactly.
Like
there's,
beyond the money.
Beyond the actual money, you
mm-hmm.
kind of, to have captured something so beautiful is kind of, you will suffer the consequences,
yeah.
kind of. And I think there's an element to that. And that's why you have names like the Heart of Fire.
Right.
Like it's very dramatic.
Right, right.
You know, let's talk about Catherine Grey, because I don't know why she's in this book. for me, it's the biggest question mark of the entire plot. How do you see her presence? And, I mean, you've already said you don't really think she's necessary to the narrative.
Yeah, she just kind of was a someone walking around with a doll so that other people could talk to her. Like, she didn't...
Yeah.
She kind of realized things at the end, I suppose, at a pivotal moment, but I don't know. She wasn't... in the same way that Murder on the Orient Express had, like, such a great cast of characters where you're like, you weren't ever really sure who it could have been, and everyone kind of had some angle. Like, she didn't. She was really benign and just kind of floated through.
Yeah. I wondered if Christy was trying her out a little bit as a potentially recurring character because so we have Hastings, who is a recurring character who typically narrates Poirot's books, and he's kind of the foil to Poirot. He's always guessing wrong. He's like the reader.
Right.
And Poirot is always like, oh, my sweet little idiot.
Yes,
at the end. And so I wondered if she was meant to be kind of a potential other type of Hastings character, because her whole thing is like she kept everything so close to her chest that even Poirot, the great Poirot, didn't know what she was thinking.
Right.
And couldn't quite figure her out. And I think...
It was also sort of a feminine touch for her to, like, go to the villas after the train ride and, like, see the other sort of players who were female and kind of have maybe more intimate conversations than...
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like Poirot is bad at, like, charming ladies.
He does that,
He's very good at that.
Yeah.
And he not in, like, a overwhelming way, but just in a, like, I'm here to talk and I want, you know, to get as much information as possible.
Mm-hmm. He calls that persona Papa Poirot.
Okay. Yeah, he's very good at it. I mean, he can be demanding, but it usually goes well.
Yeah.
But maybe Catherine was sort of a, I don't know, just a different way to sort of sneak into those moments of, like, woman-to-woman conversation.
I wish we'd gotten more of Lennox and Lady Tamplin.
Yeah,
because they
funny.
Were really funny.
Yeah, I loved it.
And chubby, her, like, 20-year-old husband or whatever he was, walking around kind of just like a little doofus.
Yeah. There were a lot of great stories that were told about, like, oh, a woman would never put her jewels in the safe, as her husband told her.
Right.
She rolled them up in her corsets and stockings, and they were thus saved by the, you know, the burglar broke into the safe.
Right.
The jewels were not stolen. She'd put all of her buttons in there. Like, all these kind of knowing things about, like, what a woman would actually do with her jewelry. I loved that.
Yeah.
One of the quotes I saved was, didn't I tell you there is no end to the lies women will tell about their jewelry? No comment, but I love it.
What does that mean to you?
That,
like, whether it's real or not?
Maybe that, maybe that ties back into paste. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you're dressed a certain way, if you're at a certain event, if you're with certain people and you have all fake jewelry, who's ever going to know? It's just sort of a circumstantial detail that if everything else is right, who's to say your jewelry is real or not? It's like how you carry it, if fake it till you make it moment.
Yeah. I know someone, and I won't name their name, who bought all her jewelry by telling her husband that it was half the price it really was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ballsy. I love
Very
it.
Very ballsy. Mm-hmm. And she has a great jewelry collection.
Yeah. And jewelry is so personal that you can kind of make up whatever story you want about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wore my rubies for today.
Beautiful.
And I could tell you anything about why I have this ring, but only I really know. Or only the owner really knows why they have it or what it means, who gave it to them. Like, there's so many things.
Yeah.
So many layers.
That's right. Yeah, and I guess I wish in the book that we'd actually heard perhaps a little bit more from Ruth Kettering about how she felt about the rubies.
Yeah, because she was gone so soon.
She was gone so soon. She's kind of treated as not a very nice person, which I guess Christy often does with her victims. We kind of don't feel that bad that they're dead because they weren't great.
Right. She's having an affair.
She's having an affair, even though her husband was having like 100 affairs. You know, I would have been interested in her take on the jewelry because she seemed to just go like, thanks so much, Dad, and like put them in her pocket.
Right, casually.
Yeah. And I guess when you're that wealthy, maybe that's just how you treat them. But we didn't get a sense of, like, her attachment to them whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And why – I mean, we know she took them on the train because the Comte de la Roche has said, I'm writing, a history of those rubies or whatever.
Yes.
Some nonsense thing. But, yeah, that was – I felt kind of missing from the story. Do you think that the jewelry in this – the jewelry heist in this book is what makes the plot, or would this have been just as interesting if there had been just a murder on a train?
If it didn't have the jewelry, it would be a dry run for murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah, basically.
I mean, but that's not to say that the jewelry really adds that much to, like, the core mystery, really. I suppose it's kind of a divergence of, like, wait, why was she actually murdered? And who actually has the stones? And, oh, wait, I think that this is what happened, but it's not really what happened.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just, it's like a half red herring or something, like a distraction.
A ruby herring.
Yeah, ruby herring. Here we go.
Yeah, I think the jewels add a nice touch. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when you're like on the train to the French Riviera and there's rubies, like there's a lot of glamorous elements of this, but I never... because I think, as you said earlier, because the plot is so diffuse and it takes such a long time, there isn't a great sense of urgency. And even Poirot, like, doesn't seem that bothered about solving the mystery. He's like, it'll happen when it happens.
Right. Right.
Which, to say that to a grieving father, he's like, you know, it was quite bold. And that doesn't really happen a lot throughout the books. He does take his time, but generally with a sense of urgency of, like, I need to solve the crime.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm just interested overall in your thoughts on the book. Like, what was your big takeaway? Are you going to be reading more Christie's after this?
I want to read a biography of her. I want to know more about her.
Yeah.
I love that you said that this was written around the same time as her, like, famous disappearance where she, like, ran away to the seaside or wherever.
She
like
went
some
to
village.
Harrogate. Yeah, she went to a spa in Harrogate, which, honestly, like... Same.
Yeah.
I wish we could
that
all go to
great.
That sounds really
How many
nice.
Times do I just want to, like, walk into a meadow and never turn around?
Exactly.
Like, and wasn't it, like, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle who, like, tracked her down or something? They had, like, some sort of friendship or...
Yes,
tell me if I'm wrong.
No, so he didn't track her down, but he did, like, he brought in a medium or a psychic, I believe, to try to solve where she had gone, and it didn't really go anywhere.
Mm.
But, yeah, he had great hopes of, like, solving it.
Wow. Yeah, so... Yes, I will read more of her work, but I want to know more about her.
Yeah.
I feel like there was just a good new biography that came out or something.
There is, one by Lucy Worsley called Agatha Christie, An Elusive Woman.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's another one called Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life, which is by Laura Thompson, who is also on the podcast, and that's a great biography as well.
Okay.
And she also wrote an autobiography,
wow.
Which is worth reading, but she does not mention the disappearance. Hmm. So...
She's like, I don't want to talk about that.
You won't learn more about it. No. And you know what's interesting is that was, you know, she kind of had like a mental breakdown. Like she was going through a lot. She left. She did tell someone where she was going, but he never communicated it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she was also just a famously private person. She did not like to give public speeches or talk to the press. So she just never talked about it again. And it was probably a pretty traumatic moment in her life.
Why should she have to?
She shouldn't have to. She's just churning out 3 books a year. Like, leave a lady alone.
Seriously.
But anyway, so if our listeners are interested in more jewelry heist fiction or nonfiction, where should they get started?
The Great Muppet Caper is on my list.
That is... we can end the podcast here. That's the best answer you could have given.
The Baseball Diamond? Come on. I love the opening scene of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom with the diamond and the ice and the nightclub.
Yes.
I think it's like in China, Shanghai or something. Mm-hmm. It's so chic.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with the plot. It's just a little like opening moment, but
a little
love
pulled
it.
Open. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. I mean, we mentioned Ocean is 8. One of my favorite jewelry movies that isn't really a heist and isn't about jewelry at all is Vertigo. But the plot hinges on that necklace.
Yes.
It is in the painting. It's a gift. It triggers his memory. It you know, makes him realize that it's the same woman. Like,
yes.
It's such a pivotal moment, and I just love everything about Vertigo.
Oh, it's such a great film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else did I have on my list? I mentioned the Moonstone. Oh, To Catch a Thief, of course, is really great.
Mm-hmm.
It's thematically about jewelry, but there's not, like, a ton of great jewelry in the movie.
Yeah.
But, yeah, those are some of my favorites.
Fantastic. So thank you so much for being here tonight. Where would you like to be found by the people? And if so, where can they find you?
Just on Instagram. Honestly, yeah. At Levi Higgs _ in the middle.
And are there any other Instagram accounts you would recommend for jewelry lovers?
Oh, my God, so many. That is a terrible question.
I'm sorry.
give
us 2.
Ha ha ha.
Sorry.
Hold on. Let me pull up some. Let me think for one moment. And then I'll like start that sentence anew,
okay,
so I don't
no
sound
problem.
Like a cretin. I just want to say some good ones.
Yeah, say some good ones.
Okay, I'm going to say one of my favorites is The Art of the Jewel on Instagram.
Okay.
Claudine is an amazing jewelry historian and has like really great archival photos and renderings and storytelling.
Yeah.
She's like a true scholar, so I really respect her. And I would also recommend Wartsky on Instagram. If you just type Wartsky, I think it's Wartsky 1865.
Okay.
They're an immaculate dealer from London. They deal in the highest quality anything, and
okay,
I just am fascinated by everything that they have. So
amazing.
Those would be my shout outs.
I will be following immediately. And I will say a book that really helped me understand jewelry and stones in general is Stoned by Aja Radin, which I really like. She's talks a lot about the science of gemstones as well, which I really appreciated, and the mining process and the history of how stones became popular from different parts of the world. So that's one I would recommend.
Great. One jewelry book I'll plug is Jewels, A Secret History by Victoria Findlay.
Okay.
And each chapter is about a different gemstone and like where it's sourced from and why it does what it does.
Uh-huh.
Like jet and a lapis from Afghanistan. It
sort of
travels the world to tell you why and how and what's the cultural history of these stones.
That sounds amazing.
Really good.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you so much for being here again, and I really appreciate you reading the book and coming and talking to me.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Levi. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you to our producer, Kate Kreshal, and our sound engineer, Winter Robinson. To stay up to date and get some extra fun info, you can follow us on Instagram at TNMurder. Rating and reviewing us really helps, so please do that if you feel so inclined. We're on all your favorite podcast platforms. Please remember to follow us there and recommend us to anyone you think might need a little extra tea and or murder in their lives. In 2 weeks, we'll be talking about Crooked House. Rent it from your local library, buy from your local independent bookstore, or if you need to buy online, we recommend bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores with every purchase. A link for next episode's book can be found in the episode notes. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Tea and Murder. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.